Okay, my name is Deva Weinstein. I'm 63. Today's date is the 23rd of October, 2008, and we're in Lower Manhattan, and I'm interviewing my friend.
I'm Norma Braun. I'm now almost 71 next week, and today's date is October 23rd, 2008, and we're in Foley Square, and this wonderful lady I met asked if she could interview me, and I said, okay.
So here we are. Now, Norma, I understand that your parents met here in the United States and that they were from different cultures, born in different countries. Could you tell us about them, please?
Sure. My father is born in China from Ningbo, and he came to the United States to go to the Wharton School to get a graduate degree because his father wanted all his children to be educated enough to bring new technology, an improved way of life to China. My father at the Wharton School had other Chinese students because there were very few women students in those schools in those days. In fact, women were not allowed in Wharton. Mm-hmm. My mother's parents were born in Poland, and they had a very Polish upbringing, but in northern Philadelphia. And her mother wanted her daughters to meet some college boys. So she sent them to the International House on the campus of the University of Pennsylvania. It was one of the first international houses in the country, if not the first, started by Quakers. At any rate, since the dominant group of students in the International House were Chinese, my mother and her two sisters met the Chinese students, and they developed an interest in each other. And that's how that all happened.
Uh-huh. And your mom's family was not pleased?
No, they were very concerned. And in fact, when my parents got married, they eloped. Mm-hmm. And she was disowned by her parents. Mm-hmm. And my father's parents could not disown him because he was number one son. Mm-hmm. But after he got his degree, with the help of my mother, who helped him with his thesis writing, because she was much better at writing than he, and in English better than he, uh-huh, too. But she went back to China with him, because that was what wives do. And then in China, she became Chinese.
Wow.
In fact, Chinese law says if you're a Chinese person marrying somebody out, that person becomes Chinese.
As Chinese citizen, just
yes,
automatically. And that move was before you were born, right?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And then your family moved to
Then went back to China and to Shanghai.
To Shanghai.
And then my father's job was to begin building railroads so that China would be connected. And my mother was put there in the household, and my grandfather was in the government. So because my father was number one son, our home became the social center when my grandfather came to town, so that other dignitaries from other cultures would come, etc.
Yeah, I just realized that you left out that interesting piece about your grandfather being the first.
My grandfather fought in the Chinese Revolution to overthrow the Manchus, went back, in fact, October 10th, 1911. He was at Yale Law School at the time, and he went back to fight in the revolution. And he became the first foreign minister from the Kuomintang. And he also became the first ambassador from China to America, to Washington, D.C., 1934.
Yeah. Family is full of history.
Yeah.
And then your three brothers were born after you.
Yeah. My sister was born first.
Right.
My older
sister. Here
in
the States.
Yeah, she was born. She was just a couple of weeks old when they went back to China. So she's the only one to become president.
Uh-huh. We're all not going to hold our breath at the moment, right?
No, I don't think so.
And then you were born in
Shanghai.
And then you're...
My first brother was born in Shanghai.
Uh-huh.
And then the war broke out. And then we tried to escape from the war, which turned out to be a monument to misspent energy. But mm-hmm, in those days, since there was no options, my two other brothers were born after that. And with one other loss, when my mother got malaria in the middle of the war, and mm-hmm, she wound up having a spontaneous
loss,
fetal
pregnancy.
Loss. Yeah.
Yeah, and you had explained to me that your mother, you said we survived by the wits of my mother. That's what you had written.
My mother was a very, very remarkable person. She has what I call emotional genius. She learned how to adjust and make things practically from nothing. We starved during the war. There was no options. And when I tried to take an oral history from her, it was the first time I realized how hard it had been for her, because she started to cry. And she didn't want to talk about it. The memories were so bad. And that was when because I remember as a child, we always had to run. And what we were running from getting bombed.
Yeah.
And she said the one place that we wound up in, which is on the Kowloon side, further inland, I don't even remember exactly where, because I was only 2-3 years old, an Englishman took us in. And he allowed us to stay a whole week, which was the longest we'd stayed anywhere when we were running. And then my mother felt badly that we were imposing on him. And apparently the day we left was the day he was interned by the Japanese.
Oh, my goodness.
And we never saw him again. So that's when she broke down and cried. She said, here's doing kindness for others.
Right.
And yet, you know, he really paid the price. And it was a terrible thing.
Your family's survival is full of stories of the kindness of others, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Because you told me that story about that, your father's schoolmate?
Yeah, schoolmate, yeah. We in addition to starving, we also wound up getting childhood diseases at the time of the war. So here we got measles, chicken pox, et cetera, all at the same time. And at that time, four of us. I wound up developing beriberi, which is a vitamin deficiency.
Right.
And I still remember I was about 7 years old. And as a child, everyone tiptoeing around me because they were anticipating my death. And no one wanted to make noise. And I felt too weak to lift my head. I couldn't lift my head off the bed. So you develop a tremendous degree of withdrawal. And because you have no energy to do anything. And at this point, I don't know how it happened and what the connection was. My father had gone to school in Japan before the war. And one of his classmates there, my father spoke Japanese, spoke English, spoke Chinese. He was linguistically gifted. But one of his classmates turned out to be a Japanese army officer. And when my father had been engaged by the Japanese to turn the factory making railroad tracks and cars into a bomb factory. And because the Japanese could not communicate with the workers, they had to keep him on to communicate with the workers to build those bombs. So when the Japanese army officer found out that it was his old classmate, my father, even though we had nothing to share, it is good manners to invite them to your home for a meal. So you share what you had.
Right.
And what we had was boiled cornstarch.
Yes.
That's it. Each is ate once a day. And the water had to be filtered and boiled before you could drink it, because it's not like in this country where you can open a tap and drink the water. It doesn't exist in much of the world, but certainly didn't at that time in China. So you would get all sorts of diseases if you didn't do that. So we had, quote, safe water as well. So he, when he found out about our plight, he actually had smuggled, because he was obviously were the enemy, he actually smuggled into us vitamins that saved my life. And he brought my mother a 100-pound bag of flour. And what did my mother do? She made yeast. She made bread with the entire 100 pounds. Because if you didn't, it would get wormy or somebody would steal it. So she made bread and she shared it, because you can't keep it forever. And so whoever was there closest to us had it. So everybody had it. The servants didn't leave us during the war because they had nowhere else to go. And they would starve just as well there as here. So,
they ran with you when your family moved to a new place?
A few of them did.
They
two
went
of them,
with
yeah.
you.
Because of all the children, they felt they were like second parents to us because they took care of us when we were little. So they came with us. It was a mother and her daughter. She was the cook, and daughter was the babysitter, sort of, kind of.
Wow.
And they did everything. They were very loyal. People were very family-oriented type of thing, and they became included in those things. But I learned a lot about my mother would make things from nothing. I mean, I don't know how she did it, but we had a few chickens, part of the war, and so whenever a chicken had an egg, the youngest got the first one. Then went up the road, and if there were any left that the parents got it, then they would have some. And then when the chickens couldn't lay anymore, then they were cooked. And then somebody stole our chickens.
Story is over and over about everybody needing so much.
Yeah, and then how you learn to do. And my mother never led us to believe we should feel sorry for ourselves. She's not got the energy for that. You just have to keep the energy, do the things you have to do. My mother shaved my sister and me bald because during the war, the Japanese soldiers walk in and rape children. So we were dressed as boys, so they couldn't tell what we were. So I hated it, but she was doing the right thing by us to protect
us. Did she explain to you why she was doing it? I mean,
understood. We understood that we would be violated, but we didn't understand what that really was.
What that meant.
Because we were too small to really understand that at that time.
And then...
So she was remarkable in that regard. She could do this. And she would never show anything but a sense of control so that no one would panic around her, whether it was the servants, my father, or any of
you
us.
You kids.
And that was her ability. I don't know how she did it, but she had that inner strength to do that.
She was an amazing woman. And she also... You told me was really instrumental in your decision to become a physician.
Very much so.
Could you tell us that really moving story because it's traumatic?
It is very traumatic. When we were small, New Year's is a big, the biggest holiday in China. It's equivalent to American Christmas. And as children, we would collect good luck money for a New Year's. And so it would be. But I was always very, very, very curious. So because you had to shop so frequently, if you had anything to buy at all, because there was no way of keeping food fresh, so you went out daily to try to obtain food. And I used to bug the servants so much to take me because I loved to see somewhere else. I loved to go in the market, the smells, the sights, the things. Chickens were alive, ducks were alive, fish were alive, and you would buy that stuff and bring it home. The chicken's legs would be tied. She'd carry a bucket to carry the fish and so on. And, of course, she would go to the apothecary, and I thought that was fascinating, all these different dried things in jars and how this person knew how to mix it, and somehow her symptoms would get better because she did this. But the other was that when she was busy, I would wander. I loved to just see what was there. And I was in those days, there weren't sewers like they have in this country. There were open rivulets of human sewage. And the roads that went over these sewers became the roofs for some people to live. They were homeless. And it was in one of these, and I was just taken by this woman because she had a large tumor in her neck, which nowadays I know is a goiter. Thyroid. But I was spellbound because she was suffocating her baby. And I couldn't understand it. I was so upset. I went up to her and asked her what she was doing. And I still remember her look and the hopelessness in her voice and her eyes saying, I was able to sell my son, but no one wants a daughter. And I can't watch her starve to death. And I was just devastated by that. And when I got home... my mother noted that I was upset, and I'm still getting upset about it today, so many years. And she said, well, you can't do anything now, but when you grow up, maybe you'll be able to help people like that. And then I said, well, what would that be? She said, well, maybe you'll be a doctor. And that was a seed. I had that. I was five at the time. And it was like I wouldn't let it go. I hung on to it. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do this. And then when I got older, especially after we came in this country, My mother said, you know, it's too hard to be a doctor. It's really, really demanding. You have to fight upstream. And maybe you shouldn't. Maybe you should do something else. I said, no, I've made up my mind. This is what I'm going to do. And everywhere along the way, people said, you can't be. You shouldn't be. You mustn't be, because girls aren't. And I said, I will be. And when she saw that I was determined, she said, go for it. I'll do everything I can to help you. I can't help you with much. Because when we came to this country, we only had a six-month visa.
Yeah.
And before the 6 months was up, the bamboo curtain went down. No Chinese could go back to China. So we were, quote, stuck here. And at that point, we had no resources. Everything was cut.
Without your dad.
Without my father. Because we'd only come, you know, my mother and five of us at that point for 6 months. She was going to visit her family. And that was when I discovered my mother wasn't Chinese. Didn't even occur to me, because we lived in a house where so many different people came and people spoke different languages. It was like normal for us. So it was here when somebody said to my mother, when all five of us were with her, somebody looked at her and said, oh, are you a missionary? Because none of us looked like her. And she said, no, why do you ask? I said, well, where'd you get these children?
Yeah.
She said, they're mine. And they looked at her and said, oh. You're a slut.
Oh, my goodness.
And I'll never forget that, because if she had adopted us, she was a saint.
Right.
But because we were hers, she was persona non grata. I said, that's not fair.
Yeah. We were talking a bit on the ride down on the subway about how you've lived basically the history of bias in this country, of prejudice. Oh, yeah. And then there's that wonderful story about that teacher. Could you tell that beautiful story?
Oh, sure. That was the highlight, because my sister, older sister, my two younger brothers, were all put in the first grade because they had no idea what our capacity was. We had very little schooling in China because of the war. And every day we got beat up after school, and we didn't know the reason. And it turned out because the students here thought we were Japanese because we were Asian-looking, and any Japanese had to be an enemy. Because they were the enemy in the Second World War. So, and whenever I would fight back, because I was older than my brothers, I would stand up for them, I would be punished by the teacher. The teacher never punished the perpetrators. So I'd go home crying to my mother, and my mother said, learn, life is unfair. You still have to go out there and deal with it. And I said, won't you come to school? Nope.
Your mother was a no-nonsense kind of woman.
You have to learn how to fight your own battles in life, and if I come and do it for you, you'll never learn. So I hated it. I went back to school. But this wonderful teacher, Sarah E. Caro, never forget her. One day she observed all this. Didn't say a word. She just, next morning, she came to my sister and me and my two brothers. You have to stay after school. Well, we as good little Asian children never questioned authority. If the teacher said, that's what you do, that's what you do. So we had to stay after school. All the other students thought we were being punished. They were gleeful, and they went home. And what she did, keeping us after school, was to teach us English. She did it by making us sit in the back of the classroom. We had to lift our heads, and we had to read out loud to her. She said she didn't care if we didn't understand what we were reading, but we were to read out loud, and she wanted to hear every syllable enunciated. And if we made a mistake, she'd correct us. And that was the beginning. Because then by the time we finished, there was nobody left to beat us up. So she was our little savior.
Yeah.
But she also began telling us about America, the country, the history. She actually took us to Gettysburg and talked about the history. And it was so rich. And she was wonderful. She had no children of her own. She was unable to. Her husband was a Pennsylvania Railroad executive. And we maintained a relationship with her until she died. So when I got married, when I had kids, I took them to meet her.
Oh.
Yeah, she became
really
family.
She really brokered the culture for you, introduced you to the culture.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful story.
She was very involved in the Freedom Foundation, which was something going on then. I don't think they exist anymore. But she believed in America. And she was a wonderful teacher. No nonsense. Never any nonsense. Firm. You knew exactly what she wanted. And she praised you when you did well, but never more than that was well done. occurred.
So did any of you actually, were any of you actually students in her class, or she observed this behavior of the other kids outside the class?
Outside of class. She was not our teacher. She became our teacher mentor.
It's a wonderful story.
It's a wonderful story. She's a wonderful woman.
That's great. And
I think these are America's unsung heroes, our teachers. I think there are a lot of them out there. They don't get much credit, you know, except by seeing the children they impact upon. I think that's so uplifting, encouraging.
Yeah. You were talking on the ride down also about the what you were taught about giving back, having a responsibility to give back.
Oh, yeah, that came from my grandfather, very much so. He felt that for people to be free, they have to be educated. To be educated, it means encompassing all of life, you know, not just the classroom, all of life. And that his philosophy was the golden rule, that you, when you learn because you're privileged, you give back and you make the world a little better place for how you're having been there. So that became our philosophy. My mother's very much so. Mm-hmm. So she said, always leave wherever you've been a little bit better if you're being there. If it's just picking up a piece of trash, that's okay too. Or if it's helping somebody when you have a chance, that's okay too. It didn't matter. Just make it better.
Does that social commitment go all the way back generations in your family?
Yeah, base goes back through at least to three or four generations. Yeah, very much so. Very much so.
And then your dad wasn't able to join you because
he being the number one son, he was also the one who stayed behind. Whenever my grandfather left the country for fear of assassination, it would be my father's job to be head of the household because he has to be in charge of family members, make sure other people are okay, that type of thing, keeping family records as best as he could, this type of thing. But he did not anticipate our not coming back. Mm-hmm. And then when the bamboo curtain fell, he couldn't leave.
And you also told me that he was placed under house arrest.
During the Great Leap Forward, everybody with a Western education was suspect. And since he had a degree from Wharton, he obviously had to be a potential enemy. Uh-huh. And since my grandfather was in the Kuomintang, he was the nationalist government and not the communist government. So they was, and he was number one son, so another reason for suspect. And by that time, he had developed tuberculosis during the war, and he never received any treatment. So he healed himself with a lot of scarring. Mm. And on top of that, he smoked. So the combination left him progressively impaired in terms of his breathing, too.
Yeah. I never thought of this before, but when you say your family ran during the war, was your father with you?
Yes, he did. He did a lot of running. I remember the first time we ran, we were asleep at night, and he just came into the bedroom and scooped us up in our pajamas. He had a sheet with a few things in it, a few clothes, a little bit of food, and my job was to carry a thermos of water. And then we ran, and then we looked back, and the house was gone, bombed.
Oh, my goodness.
So, I never forget that day. I remember feeling my legs weren't long enough to run fast enough, and I felt like I was going to be left behind. It was so scary because I was a little over two.
Yeah. Wow. And then your mother, I mean, she experienced changing cultures, first moving from the States with your dad.
Mm-hmm.
So she learned Chinese in China?
Yes, she did.
She hit the mat running, so to speak.
Absolutely.
And taught herself?
Part of the reason was no one in the family would speak with her because she was persona non grata, and my father had married out. So bias was there, too. So the only people who would speak with her were the servants. Mm-hmm. And they spoke no English. So pretty soon, I mean, she's very quick. She's very good ear. She spoke Chinese without an accent. So she learned it. And she learned different dialects because different servants had different dialects. And it was about maybe a year, year and a half after she was in China when at a family gathering, my grandfather had come. And in those days, you know, no TV, no radio, no nothing. The family gathers around the table and they tell stories, just like we're talking here, like this.
Mm-hmm.
So my grandfather would always hold fort, and he would sometimes mix it with humor. And one of the stories was funny, and my mother was laughing across the table. and he suddenly noticed her laughing, and he said, "What are you laughing at?" And she said, "At your story."
Uh-huh.
And she said, "Did you understand me?"
Uh-huh.
And she said, "Yes." And she repeated the whole story in Chinese.
Oh, wow.
His mouth fell open, and he said, "Please come here." And he had the servant put a seat on his right side. And from then on, she ate on his right hand side.
Uh-huh.
And when she became accepted by my grandfather, in fact, he was probably one of our staunchest supporters of all of us,
yeah,
too, as children.
Yeah.
Focused on education, teaching us about giving back, teaching,
right,
us about how we take advantage of our opportunities, but give back for people who help you get them.
He was such a strong presence.
He was,
huh?
I mean, he was so right on in so many ways, because he, uh-huh, felt that war should be fought in the athletic field and by valor, by achievement, and not by battle in the battle. He hated war. I guess seen so much of it.
Yeah.
Hated war. And he said, we have to educate our people so that they don't go.
So here's your mother who learned the language on her own. I mean, he must have been very respectful of her.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Ability to do that.
Absolutely. And she retained it. She retained it. I mean, we as children fought against our Chinese because we were segregated and isolated.
Yeah. Here.
Yeah. And when people used to ask us, the other kids in school, talk that funny talk, they would say.
Mm-hmm.
And you would feel embarrassed. And so you wanted to forget it, which was not a good thing.
Yeah.
But my mother retained much more than we did. And
we
retained the childhood level and that's not very good for as an adult. Yeah.
And how many years back do these family reunions go? I know that you've told me, like just this fall,
we were supposed to have a big one to celebrate my grandfather's 126th birthday as a way of getting the family there. They thought it would be easier to dovetail after the Olympics to do that because of my grandfather's interest in support of education. Ningbo University was established.
Uh-huh.
And part of the family was going to do was actually the family together would provide the support to develop a department of music. Because my grandfather was very, very supportive of all the arts. He said, you have to become whole people.
Uh-huh.
And you need to know the arts to become whole. So the music was what we were going to set up. But it was so difficult to accomplish, we wound up not doing it this year. We had several others. One was to celebrate my uncle, who was murdered by the Japanese,
mm-hmm,
martyred, in fact, during the war. And they were going to reinter him in an equivalent of a Arlington cemetery,
mm-hmm,
near Beijing.
Mm-hmm.
So the family was supposed to gather for that, but that was, and we were all ready. We had our tickets, we were all ready to go. And then, boom, we couldn't go because Tiananmen Square broke out just before.
I remember that, right.
Yeah, so everything was held back. Right. And then after that, you know, it's so hard to get organized everybody together.
Yeah, because you're talking a large family.
Oh, huge, huge. It was very, very difficult. So we didn't, and so we've done most of our reunions here. The East Coast Coalition, the West Coast Coalition.
Because I was going to ask when and if you were able to return to China when your mother was still alive, was she able to go with you?
Well, actually, we tried to arrange it, and it was one of her birthday presents to go back. Then after about 3 months, she changed her mind. And she changed her mind for a very fundamental reason. She said, no one is alive that I knew.
Uh-huh.
Nothing we had is there any longer.
Uh-huh.
I'm not going back to anything. I don't want to go. It'll just be a memory of a time when I can't find what I knew. So she decided against it. And so she's so pragmatic. I figured, you know what, Mom, you're right. I'm not going to do this. That's why I was trying to tape her oral history.
Mm-hmm.
And then when it was so painful for her, I felt very badly. But now I regret not kicking her to do it more, because I did, mm-hmm, some, but I could have done so much more.
Yeah,
because she knew all these people who came through, and she knew what was going on, and she never faltered in helping to support us.
How did she do that? She basically overnight became a single mom.
Yeah, exactly. It was very, very, very hard. I mean, the only job she could get
as an immigrant.
Yeah,
but not an immigrant,
right?
You know,
she had no resume because she was out of the country all those years. Her major job was having kids, right? So it's,
mm-hmm,
that it's considered by most people not a resume, even though women who have children who run a household are extremely organized. But in fact, she applied for a position and beat out over 100 other applicants based on her interview. And she was so afraid to take the job that she would fail that she wound up not doing it. And I said, that's totally not her personality. So I was curious why that happened. She realized that she, being also outspoken, she spoke up readily, that she needed to be her own boss and not somebody else's.
Not work for somebody.
Right. So when things were really desperate, there was a small luncheonette that was failing, in part because the owner was an addicted gambler. So she thought she could make a deal with him that he couldn't refuse.
This is in Philly.
And she took it over, and she said, I will take over, I will run it, you'll have nothing to do with it, I will let you live with us because you won't have any problems with where to go, but and I will slowly pay off your debt. But that was no cash up front. And he was in such bad debt, he wound up taking it. So she turned this place around. She ran it totally. It was breakfast to dinner. We all learned how to work in it. We all were cashiers, soda jerks, sunny makers, sandwich makers. She did the cooking.
You'd come home from school and you'd go to the luncheonette.
Yep, and work there. But every morning, she said, no matter what happens, we'll always have something to eat. And even if we never make a profit. And the luncheonette came up with an apartment above it.
Mm-hmm.
So we lived there that way. And she thought that's how we made it. So every morning we'd come down, pick up our lunch bags for school, go to school, come home, right back to square one. Homework came first, and then you get into work. And we did all kinds of different things. Of course, on weekends, too.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if that luncheonette is still there.
I don't know.
With that original name.
I don't know. I haven't been back there to find out, because after she left Philadelphia, we didn't, go.
She sold it, or...
Yeah, she did. She did. Because when my youngest brother left for the Air Force, she said, my kids don't need me anymore. They're on their own.
Mm-hmm.
And she got rid of it. Just like that.
Hmm.
No nostalgia or anything. And at that point, she refused to remarry until all her children were on her own. She said, no man's other children will have the same affection. They may say so, but they're not the same.
Mm-hmm.
So she said she would never remarry until the all of us were out of the house. And she did. She married a Swedish immigrant.
Gosh.
And they were married for 23 years. And then when he died, she said, well, I have nobody to shovel snow. So she left Philadelphia and went to the West Coast. And lived
near your sister.
Yeah, nearer. She was not very near initially. She lived in Victorville because it is dry heat. And at that point, she had arthritis. And the dry heat, she had the least pain. So she took up gardening, and she did things very few people do. She makes pomegranate juice. She would harvest all the pomegranates from her trees. She would shell them all.
Oh my God. She would squeeze
them all. She would concentrate it, cooking it, and she would freeze the concentrated juice in the ice cube trays and use a cube at a time for whatever she wanted, for drinks, for cooking, for what have you. So she was way ahead of her time in so many ways. She did her own gardening, and... She raised grapes. I didn't know they were Chardonnay grapes, except they tasted wonderful. But a neighbor would collect the grapes, and he would make the wine and give her some wine back. And so in California, you can do that in Victorville.
Yeah.
It's a dry, sunny terrain, and it was wonderful. And so I learned from her a lot about flexibility and letting the past go, not holding on to things, not being angry about bad things happening to you, because bad things happen to everybody. And it was wonderful to learn from her also to have a sense of humor to deal with life. I mean, one of the most memorable experiences I had was somebody would, in a restaurant, some steady customers would give her advice. And she would just say, it's so wonderful that you give me advice. And whenever you pay my bills, I'll take them. But people would laugh, embarrass, but they would never
do it again.
And so she never had to say, mind your own business.
Yeah.
And that would just create anger.
It's interesting because here's your mom, born in the States of Polish parents, and we're talking about that Asian ability to say pretty direct things indirectly. So this is a great example of
and I'm sure
politeness
she learned
to the nth.
Yeah, politeness to the end. And that's, she said, you never lose your self-respect.
Mm-hmm.
That no one can take that from you, your self-respect. No one. You have to give it away. So if you want to do that, you can do it.
Mm-hmm.
But that's up to you.
Mm. You know, the other story I was thinking of on the ride down, Norma, is remember you told me about marrying between your second and third years of medical school and your whole experience of prejudice and...
Well, 10% women in those days in medical schools, now over 50%.
Right. So for starters, you got this whole gender
The whole
difference.
Thing. Yeah, exactly. And I was at Columbia. My husband was at Penn. And he wanted to get married. He said, I don't want to lose you. I think if I marry you, I won't lose you. I said, you won't lose me but I wanted to wait to get married after school because my focus was going to school.
Yeah.
And when I went to Columbia with a fellowship, it was the first time in my life that I went to school and didn't have to work. Because every high school, college, I always worked and went to school because I had to pay my own way. My mother could only give us so much. It was very limited, buying books, things of that type. And I was determined that I was going to do it. So I was doing it. So when other kids had dates, I was working. And I didn't resent it because, you know what? It's very nice, but it's not going to get my goal. My goal was to become a doctor, and I knew how to work twice as hard because for a woman to get in, it was very hard. So I did, and I was very, very fortunate. I wound up getting a fellowship at Columbia. So when I got to Columbia and I could just go to school, it was like, oh, what luxury. Mm-hmm. Just being a student, I go to the library instead of going to a job, you know.
Yeah.
I would get lost in the archives because I'd find the archives of hospital journals of Guy's Hospital in London from 1830.
Uh-huh.
It was wonderful. So to me, it was a wonderful experience. Well, anyway, losing my train of thought because of this, but nevertheless.
The experience of the name.
Yeah, exactly. So here we on my fellowship, my husband said, well, why don't we get married now between my second and third year? I said, after a lot of thought, thinking about it, I said, okay, we could do that. Because then we could also apply for a summer public health grant to study abroad, doing a project away.
Yeah.
And that was very exciting. So, in fact, both of us went to Panama for the summer. We did separate projects, but interesting projects. But in the process, we had to get married first because my in-laws did not look favorably upon us taking off for the summer by ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Without being married. So we got married. Then it was a decision whether I would take my husband's name or not. And that was a big decision. Because, why? Because my family wanted me to use my maiden name professionally, which was Wong.
Mm-hmm.
And it was hard to not do that, especially for my grandfather, whom I honored. And my mother said, it's up to me. It's my life, my name. I have to do it. Make my own decision. But my husband's name was Braun. I said, you know, all my life I've been at the end of the alphabet.
Mm-hmm.
I get to move up. And that was a fun experience. It was really a good thing to do. And it was different being at the front of the alphabet instead of the end of the alphabet. So very few people have that opportunity unless they marry into it.
Mm-hmm.
So that worked out.
Mm-hmm. And then you get these confused looks on other people's faces.
That's the best part. Yeah. That was one of the things because of the bias. Because the minute they see you with an Asian name and an Asian face, they would connect you with an expectation.
Mm-hmm.
When I married as a Braun, they would look at me and people would say, you don't look like your name. But you mean the expectation was not there, especially since I do not speak with an accent, which was due to Mrs. Caro. So that was part of that, too.
So many wonderful stories. I mean, if we had the time, I'd want to ask you how you helped your kids understand about bias and, you know, their really mixed cultural experience and, you know.
Well, for them, it's stories. Yeah. When I tell them about different things that have happened, it's stories. The advantage of being in New York is actually there's more to see here to make the story slightly more real.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we go into Chinatown, we go into different areas, you know, they'll see more of one or another kind of people. And children look at people as people. They don't look at them with bias. I mean, Richard Rogers was right. You have to be taught to hate. And you have to be taught that because they're different, there's something bad about them. And that's what we have to erase.
Mm-hmm.
We're all human beings.
Well, your commitment to that, you come by it honestly, because here's your folks experiencing bias because they love each other and they marry. And then in one culture, they're biased and they have to earn acceptance. And they have to come to this culture and they have to go through it again. And It seems that, and then politically, your grandfather and your father having the experience of being other politically when China was shifting. So, I mean, it's a family story of proving that, like you say, we're more alike than we are.
Different. Yeah.
And overcoming this.
And it's the human spirit that you believe in.
Well, it certainly strongly comes through in your family. There is.
Yeah, I feel very fortunate for the family that I have. We're all different as night and day.
Yeah, if we had time, you could tell us about the children your brothers have adopted. I mean, the difference goes on and on and on in such wonderful ways.
We're lucky to be in this country. This is the best country in the world. Despite all the problems, there are people who care and are working on them. Mm-hmm. Maybe it won't happen overnight. But in the Asian culture, not overnight is okay. Just keep at it. Just keep at it, keep at it, keep at it. And that's how you make a change. Changes may come slowly, but the world is better than it used to be. And I'm hoping we don't destroy it in the interim, because I think there's better can be in the future, too. That's what I believe in for my grandchildren now.
I think this is kind of a natural place for us to stop because none of your stories are short.
Unfortunately.
And 10-second sound bites. So I really want to thank you for doing this.
No, thank you for asking me. It's just...
Now you have the disc for your kids and your grandkids.
Yeah, I want to give that to them, their history.
Yeah.
All right. Absolutely.
Thank you.
We keep family pictures for that reason so they're up so they can see them.
Great. Well, thank you.
Thank you for asking me.
Okay.
We are out of time, but I would like to ask one question.
Sure.
What did it mean to you to finally become a physician?
Oh.
And do you remember that day?
Absolutely. I couldn't tell you more. Having worked so hard to do this, and I also won one of the prizes at graduation, it was not a prize just for the grade you accumulated. It was a prize for solving a clinical problem, which I loved. To me, I love problem solving. It's interesting. It's stimulating. And you go in. It's an essay exam. You're given one question. And all the students who are invited to take the exam are the ones who got an A in that topic, in their rotation. So you had to excel in that in the first place. And it was in pediatrics. So I remember doing that, and then at graduation day, the gift was a check. The prize was a check in which my husband and I could take a vacation together for the first time.
Oh, my goodness.
So that was quite a thing. And then, of course, getting the degree, my mother being there. My father's youngest brother was here at this time, so he was the only one from the family. My grandfather had died during my third year in medical school. That was devastating because I really wanted him to see the graduation, but he couldn't. But I remember getting that degree and saying, you know, I'm finally the doctor. Now, can I measure up? So that was my next concern. You know, how will you function as a physician? What will you do? And I took what my grandfather taught me way back, and one of my teachers, too, in medical school. And that was to leave every encounter you have with a patient, leave him or her feeling better for you having been there, regardless of whether you could cure them, because then you'll fulfill your role as a physician. So I teach that now. Mm-hmm. I try to. That's been the goal. The question is, how do you translate that for your students, for them to have the emotional understanding of that? Because it's not the intellectual understanding. It is the emotional understanding that allows them to relate to each patient
as
a
person. That's the hardest part to teach.
Yeah.
That's the hardest
part. You can't get that in a textbook, on the internet, on the blog. You have to see it happen. And... that's where teaching in the medical setting is probably more demanding and specific, because you can't do it in a group of 100. You have to do it in small groups, so it's more labor intensive. And you have to have encounters in which the patient allows you to have somebody else come in who doesn't know, and the patient is willing to be a subject to learn from. that's a gift in itself for that person to do, that patient to do. Mm-hmm. So I think that, for me at least, since every human being is interesting, I find every encounter a new experience. And for that reason, it's fun for me.
I love to be curious.
To be curious and to want to share it. Mm-hmm. And I love to teach for that reason. I never thought I was a good teacher until I started doing it.
Doing the clinical teaching.
Yeah, clinical teaching, right.
Yeah.
In the laboratory, too, but that's different. Mm-hmm. In all the talks that I give now, I still do a lot of lectures, is I call it finding the Velcro moment, finding the moment when it sticks. Mm-hmm. And you have to see your audience for that. If you don't see them, you don't know what the impact is. Mm-hmm. If I'm looking at faces, I have a better idea of whether they're getting it or they're losing their attention, in which case I can shift my pitch and even shift my story a little bit of how to try to reach them. Because the purpose of teaching is hopefully to impart something. That's what I'm trying to do.
They're lucky to have you.
Well, maybe. Maybe not. Depends. You know what? It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Because everybody takes with it from their own experience.
What they need.
Yeah. It may be terrible. It may be great. I mean, I had one student say to me once, that was horrible. And I said, all you dealt with was this person's reaction to her cancer. I wanted to learn more about that cancer.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, you're right. But maybe you won't understand this until you realize a person is the whole and the disease is a part.
Mm-hmm.
But that disease impacts on the person and you have to treat the whole, not just the disease. And, well, she went off. She was very high-pressured, high-geared, A-getting student. And I would always say, you know, your patients are not going to grade you. They're going to either die or not come back. So the goal is not the grade. The goal is what you can learn and how you can use what you learn. So about 3 years later, she had a child. And after that, she changed.
Kids will do that to you, huh?
Yeah. They'll well, part of it, people. She became a patient.
Yeah.
You know, as a mother, because in our society, when you have childbirth, you're patient.
Mm-hmm.
In third world, it's what happens every day, so you don't get any special treatment because you're having a baby. So that's what made the change when she had a child. Because you become so protective of your child. And I was shocked after my first child was born when I realized that I would kill to protect him.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't even imagine myself killing anything, maybe an ant, but a human life, I couldn't. But for my child, I realized I would become a warrior. I would protect him. And you realize that that's biologically developed in you to protect your child.
Yeah.
To protect the infant, protect the helpless.
Yeah, it brings us back to the other story, how hard it must have been for that mother to do that. But doing it out of love.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, reading Toni Morrison's story, I couldn't read it. I couldn't read it. My husband says, you have to read this story. And it was how a woman killed her child. Well, I got to that. I said, I can't read this. I cannot read this. Don't ask me to. I can't. Emotionally, it was too difficult.
Yeah.
She's a wonderful writer, but I couldn't read it. I can't read some of the stories that people write about China now, about the wartime. I can't. I mean, people are well-beady. The Rape of Nanking. My mother was saved. We were saved by the Dutch embassy because my mother knew them from there. And they came through. They killed 35,000 people in one day. Wanton killing by the Japanese in Nanking.
Okay. Now we really have to stop. Because we've been given the sign, but you have so many stories, just so many stories for us to learn from. So I really do thank you again.
Oh, you're welcome. I hope it's meaningful for someone.
Yeah, I'm sure it will be for your kids.
Yeah.
And others too. Yep.